flow is 2 a.m. I'm at it again. Me and the beat tight like a pad in the pen. Juicy gin, teller and pen, money and sin. Concession on your bright night.
To SER's Arts and Culture Show.
Don't make me say it's so hot right now.
That's caliente ahora!
Your weekly dose of arts and culture.
And all of that sort of stuff.
It's that weird thing that they're classics because they're classics because they're classics, and then they become the classics and everyone wants to do the classics because they're classics.
He's amazing.
Well, you need a lot of room for all that blood.
And he's hot as a firecracker.
You're listening to So Hot Right Now. You better not use me saying that.
Amazing babes.
On 2SER 107.3.
Hello, hello, hello. You're listening to So Hot Right Now, your weekly dose of arts and culture right here on 2SER 107.3. My name is Sophie and we have a massive show for you today. 4A have a brand new exhibition opening this week called Temporary Certainty, and we're going to be talking to artist Lana Hunt all about it. Also, artist Lulu Campbell-Smith will be chatting about a collaboration she did with her mother and grandmother in exhibition Bloodlines. And at the Fringe that's coming up, we're going to be chatting It's Only Creepy If They're Hot with the writer and a director of that. And as always, Charlie Alatia coming in for a chat for Gaggle of Geeks. So big show here. But of course, it's always about stories, ideas and music right here on So Hot Right Now. So here's a tune from Melanie Horsnell. It's called Annabelle.
Aube vintage, air vie sur un manège, chocolat au petit-déj, et monsieur Paulette, il fond de la bicyclette, son bras sur la grande roue, quel con de fait la vie, si on s'appelle Annabelle, vient d'une école de mode, préfère le prêtre, grand chose ses yeux de biche, je pense. Les boléros, elle aime tant les voyages, c'est une aventurière, conte de fées rouge à lèvres, elle s'appelle Annabelle. Que cheval, un mot secret dans son journal, les frais et grands succès, jolie poupée, belle toilette, pas une reine de beauté, c'est un drôle de phénomène, pompon et cinéma, cinq secrets Annabelle.
Tistic or could just do with winning $1,000? The Petersham Bowling Club's annual Sculptures by the PBC competition is coming up on Sunday, September 9. So get creative and start thinking of how you could reuse and recycle your everyday items into a new piece of art. Entry's free and open to anyone. To enter, check out the pbc.org.au for more information. Petersham Bowling Club are proud sponsors of 2SER.
You're listening to So Hot Right Now, your weekly dose of art and culture. This Thursday, the Foray Centre for Contemporary Asian Art will open Temporary Certainty. This exhibition delves into the complexities intervention into the greater Asia region and the resulting historical change. Temporary Certainty presents newly commissioned works by artists Rushdie Anwar, Alana Hunt and Saka Protik, all of which are signified by their creation within conditions of uneasy reconciliation. This morning we are joined by artist Alana Hunt, who will help us unpack her work, Faith in a Pile of Stones. This work unpacks environmental, technological and economic intervention of white Australia. Good morning, Alana.
Hi, Sophie. Thanks for having us.
Not a problem. A lot to unpack right there.
Yeah, I guess Faith in a Pile of Stones has begun, I think, from a place of wanting to sort of unsettle the certainty of white Australia's settlement. And the town that I live in, Kununurra, was built in conjunction with this dam wall, which created a dam that's now 20 times the size of Sydney Harbour. So that was built to kind of shift the economy from cattle to agriculture, or the reliance of predominantly cattle to agriculture where I live. And it's kind of this big dream of agricultural development in the north, and another step towards colonisation of that place, and it never really reached its peak. But it's a place that people come to and see, like, they appreciate the beauty of the place, but there's a really dark kind of violent history that underlies it. And so when I look at that dam wall, it's literally made out of thousands of stones that have been blasted from a hillside there in what was like the largest non-nuclear explosion in Australian history.
Whoa.
And they're like these giant stones just balancing on top of each other in this big wall that holds like a mass amount of water. And I just see that wall crumbling, you know? And sure, it's lasted almost 50 years, but when you think about 500 years, 5,000 years, when you start thinking about the scale of deep time, you kind of see that wall as something fragile, not as permanent as we kind of think it to be. And although the town of Kununurra was built because of that dam, when that dam breaks, it will also be destroyed and flooded, swamped by that very same dam. So I kind of see that as a metaphor for Australia as well. Yeah.
Interesting week for Australia, I must say. It's in the East Kimberley. For people in Sydney, what is that area look like?
Well, I think it's savannah. It's sort of a midway between the tropics and desert. So we get massive wet seasons, and then we get like 6 months of the year or 9 months of the year that are completely dry with no rain.
Wow.
So during the winter, then over the summer, we get like a monsoon. So it's quite dramatic environmentally. There's a lot of change. It goes from kind of brown, red dust to like a million shades of green every year. And I think that was something too, that when it was kind of invaded and settled by Europeans kind of in the late 1800s and early 1900s, there was that desire to kind of try and hold on to that mass of water that came every year and then disappeared. So that's something that fed into the dam there. But it's also like the town I live in Kununurra has, you know, like everywhere in Australia, it's got a really difficult and violent history, recent history, and that permeates the present as well in pretty strong ways.
And when you say that, are you talking about the mass incarceration of Indigenous peoples there, or?
Yeah, like that's a reality. There's like a lot of, even things like a glance can be violent, a glance walking down the street, and I think there's a lot of racial and class divisions where I live. And, so I think about that a lot, and, yeah.
So how do you try to deconstruct that in this work in particular?
Well, one aspect of the work was that there's an amazing there's a Kununurra has a historical society and a small museum, and they've got an amazing collection of archival images that I was looking through, so I was looking through those images and drawing a lot of inspiration from them, and I wanted to incorporate some of them into the installation here. Unfortunately, from two different sources, when I requested use of the images, I was told I wasn't allowed to use them. And one component of that was on the basis that I would create a myth out of the history. And for me, it wasn't so much about creating myths out of history. It was differing accounts of history that I'm interested in. And I think there was a hesitation about, you know, hopefully the de-glorification of the European settlement of that place that my work is working with, rather than the glorification of it. And so I was a bit stumped when I couldn't use the images, but then I realised that I could just reshoot them. Mm. So we reshot some of the archival images, and I got a friend to pose in them. And a lot of the landscape and environment hasn't changed that much. So I think kind of that's one way that kind of reworking the historical archive is one thing that, yeah.
There seems to be a sense of fragility as well. People just like, nah, you can't break that kind of thing.
Yeah, well, that's it exactly. Fragility is something that I've thought about right from the start in this, you know, our faith, like Australia's faith, Kununurra's faith, that this pile of stones here will not fall down and the town will not be drowned and swamped. And so there is a fragility there, but that also extends to kind of hesitations over controlling history and what's recorded and what's not. There's a big fragility there, I think.
Is it also the sense of trying to control nature, considering the extremities that exist in the East Kimberley?
Yeah, I'm not sure if it's definitely an attempt to control nature and manage nature. So the way before the dam was built, the water would run through a river and out to the ocean, you know, and now it's held and it's maintained and it's released at a steady rate throughout the year, and it's spread through agricultural crops and goes down a river that now is, you know, at a relatively stable height, whereas in the past it would have gone down to a trickle or dried up during the dry season and then built up again during the wet. So there's that, I think, trying to manage people, trying to manage the environment, trying to manage society are all things that nations, governments spend their time doing.
Mm.
Yeah.
So this exhibition also has works by Rushdie Anwar and Saka Protik. How did you find your work fitting in with theirs?
Yeah, it's actually been really exciting. I did my master's in India and I was there for 3 years, and I think my understanding of the world generally, but specifically of nations and colonisation and history and contemporary politics and stuff was really influenced by my time there, and particularly my engagement with Kashmir.
Mm.
I've always, when I moved back from India, I moved up to the Kimberley in 2011, and I always felt resonances between there and South Asia, particularly through the history and kind of contemporary realities. So what's quite exciting about this exhibition is that it places the north of Australia, which we don't often hear about in the rest of Australia, in conversation with a wider Asian political and social context and artistic expression.
Mm.
That's also connected, I think, to like a lot of the drive to develop and kind of the north of Australia is driven also by like an underlying sense that it will be invaded by Asia if we don't. And so there's a video that I have in the work that kind of draws on historical archives that reference that.
Good old swamp.
Yeah, so, you know, Australia is not isolated from Asia. Like, we are a part of it.
Yeah.
And so talking about the North in this context is really good.
Yeah. You also have a project in the works called The Borderline. Does that kind of explore this concept further?
Yeah. The Borderline is something that has emerged from a few places. One is definitely my engagement with borders through my work in Kashmir as well, and then wanting to bring that and create a community around that where I live in Kununurra. So my in-laws' country, traditional country, my mother-in-law is Mirrawong, and her country extends on both sides of the WANT border. And so that border, you know, as banal as borders can be in Australia, at least our state borders, has actually had a large impact on her ability to assert rights over her traditional country, because the different state governments have different laws around that. So there's constant kind of bureaucracy that you're negotiating there. So the Borderline was a way to engage collaboratively with other people around all ideas relating to the border and create connections between where I live locally and the Asia Pacific as well. Yeah.
Fantastic. Well, Alana, thank you so much for joining us here today on at 2SER, but we can't wait to see the work unfold on Thursday.
Yeah, I look forward to seeing you. Thank you.
No worries. We've been speaking with Alana Hunt all about temporary certainty. The exhibition opens this Thursday at the Foray Centre for Contemporary Asian Art in Sydney's Chinatown. There's also a series of panel discussions, and we'll put all those details up on our show page, So Hot Right Now, on at 2SER.com. Going to jump back into the music now. Here's a bit of Alofa Arnold with Overcome. You're into SER. For Arnold there with Overcome. You're listening to So Hot Right Now, your weekly dose of arts and culture. And now it's time for your pop culture fix.
To the Batmobile. Let's go. Atomic batteries to power. Turbines to speed.
Roger. Ready to move out.
Holy smokes, Batman. It's Gaggle of Geeks on 2SER.
Good morning, Tali Alatia.
Hello, Sophie Lai.
How are you going on this fine Saturday morning?
I am doing so well.
So
I'm
well.
Sprightly. I'm up and at 'em. I'm living my best life.
Are you?
Yes. Are you living your best life?
I hope so. I'm really hoping to get through a lot of Netflixing this weekend.
Oh, I have so much life admin to do. I need a PA.
Yeah. Well, I've got life admin, but I also have I feel like I have a backlog of Netflix that I really need to get through. Like, I tried to, like, you know, get some of it done over the week, but then my Netflix kept, like, freezing because my computer is a piece of crap.
What's on the top of the list?
Well, it's definitely to finish To All the Boys I've Loved Before.
I'm offended that you haven't watched it in full. Like, why are you finishing it? You either start it to watch it for the first time or you watch it for the 12th millionth time.
Well, I started and then I got... circle because my laptop just does not like me.
That's the worst.
I feel like the battery's about to fall out, like on the verge of breaking down.
It's on the precipice of destruction.
Yeah, pretty much. So why that's top of my list.
Okay, I'm happy that it's on the top.
Yeah. But this is Gaggle of Geeks, where we talk all things geek culture and pop culture. And this is an old school show that we're talking about today.
Is it
old school? Would you call it old school?
It's one of those things that I would call it old school because it feels like it happened to me when I was in a different time of my life. But I mean, it still happened within the past 10 years.
Yeah.
10 or so years. Yeah. So I'm going to say old school because it was probably when I was at school and therefore feels right.
But it's Veronica Mars.
Veronica Mars. I loved that show.
Mm.
Like, it was so, so good. Kristen Bell as the kind of Nancy Drew character who was solving the, essentially, it started out pretty bleak when you think about it. The first episode is about date rape. Exactly. Getting sexually assaulted at a party. And then her doing her best, like, Nancy Drew, going, it's like, it happened when I was at school. I'm going to find the person who did it.
And it's like, it's sad that she has to kind of also go to those measures.
I know it is.
Even though her dad is the cop, the local sheriff's like, nah.
Look, in hindsight, I never really picked that up. I was just like, oh, naturally, you want to find out what happened. You go, you. But yeah, look, maybe she should have gone to the police and do it. But I think that would have been a totally different show.
Probably. She just had no faith.
Exactly. And I think that there's also the thing that the running theme through Veronica Mars was this sense of justice, is that she wanted justice to be served. And by her doing the work, it was also like, I feel like, not that I was Veronica Mars, but I feel like she would have thought it was quite a cathartic process to go through the dealing with what happened to her, to go through the steps of this, to find out the person and then bring them to justice and then yay. And obviously in doing so, that show created such a huge loyal fan base of marshmallows.
Oh, little marshmallows.
I love a fandom with a fun name. Marshmallows is good.
What are other good fandom names?
Oh, that's a good question. My head just went to Lady Gaga.
Little Monsters.
Yeah.
Because Doctor Who are Whovians.
Whovians. Oh, yeah. Where is... Oh.
Like...
Oh, my God. Why am I... I'm just thinking of singers and I just went to Justin Bieber. They're called Beliebers.
Beliebers. I mean, what is it? Benedict Cumberbatch. He used to be like the Cumber bitches.
Until he actually said, hey guys, don't refer to yourself as that, which is like.
So they've got a new name, but I don't know what the new name is. Although Chris Pine, his were the Pine Nuts.
Oh, see, that's fun. I think that's the good thing. Like if you've got a fun name that you can work into your fandom, if not, you have to create it and then hope it catches on.
Mm.
But the excitement of Veronica Mars is potentially...
Reboot by Hulu.
I know. Although Hulu have not come out and confirmed this yet.
No.
But, you know, that has not stopped the fandom of Marshmallows being like, yay, Hulu, thank you, well done.
But it's like, yeah, they're like, I think it's because mainly the producers...
Yeah.
Not, I mean, because Hulu will be the distributor, but it's like the producer's like, oh, yeah, we're going to reboot this. Yeah, we're totally up for it. Yeah, Kirsten Bell's totally coming back.
Yeah, well, and this is the thing is like Kirsten Bell has joked and being like, it's going to be like, what was it, Murder, She Wrote or something when she's 80 to reprise the character. So
she'll be Miss Marple.
So lucky for us, like Veronica Mars is not going to end anytime soon. And the fact is that the fandom still love it so much that, and they like, the movie that came out in 2014, they were the ones who were, like, behind that. So I'm just saying I feel that even though Kirsten Bell jokes about still being Veronica Mars at 80, is that
she will be
because we will still be there in the petitions going, yes, we want more Veronica Mars.
But I think someone asked, like, oh, but why do you need a Veronica Mars right now? And they're like, well.
Look at what's happening.
Men are still shit. I think was the direct quote.
How funny would that be? I'm just going to go outside and check the temperature of what's going on out there. Yep, men are still shit. It's still relevant.
Still relevant.
If anything, just play the old episodes, pretend you just released it this year. Boom.
I know. Oh, can we Photoshop that phone into an iPhone? Okay, great. No, make sure it's a 10, not a 6. Okay, cool. We're good.
Totally back up to date. It's all good. Oh, yeah, because all her little...
Anyway, the noughties fashion's coming back. We're fine. We're fine.
All her little investigative, like, this is how I do things, it would totally be changed in this new high-tech world. I'm pretty sure there was
hacking.
Oh, could you imagine? I remember an episode of Veronica Mars, and I'm pretty sure this happened, or I dreamed it, but I'm pretty sure it happened, where her dad was explaining to her about passwords and how you have to make them super complex. And so she's having this dialogue going, oh, I know that these passwords are really complex. So she had to actually find someone's password. And then I remember looking at it and I was like, no one makes passwords that difficult ever.
Is his still most top, like, two? Is still QWERTY?
Yes.
And Password by old parents.
But wasn't one like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6? It was like sequential numbers, letters, but then, yeah, QWERTY or Password.
Yeah.
I remember,
so clever.
So clever. I would be hacked in a heartbeat because I know that safety is have different passwords, but I'm like, no, nope, same one for everything.
I'm lazy.
Yeah, same.
It's just like, I'm like, well, you can hack it, but you won't get much out of this account is what I feel. So bad. Don't hack me, please.
And everyone's on their computers going, oh, and her computer's really shit, so it'll take her a while to like fire back anything. This is genius. But yeah, I'm excited for a reboot. But it's one of those things. I like, do you feel like sometimes we get a bit of reboot fatigue, like excitement, because there's always something that's like, they're gonna reboot it.
Well, that's just it. It's like, are there no original ideas left?
Well, and this is like, yeah,
and then everyone's too scared to take a risk on something new that's out there that challenges the status quo. They're like, no, no, just reboot.
It's reboot. Yeah.
Reboot. Nostalgia. But it's like, there's so much nostalgia one can take.
Yeah.
Or you can go like, you know, the Stranger Things route, which is like nostalgia, but something completely new and different.
Yeah. And I think that that's the problem with the reboot and how, like, with reboot fatigue is that you run the very real risk of ruining the thing that people love. And therefore, once they don't, they just go, oh, no, it's stupid. You've probably already committed to a season, or you've committed to all this extra stuff. So I think that sometimes they actually have to look at it and go, is this in the best interest of what the original idea was? And what are we trying to do right now?
But it's also, can you keep it fresh and new?
Exactly, with storylines that actually evolve. It's like when they brought Will and Grace back, and then the final episode that they summed it all up, and then in the first episode of the reboot, they were like, oh, it all just happened to be Karen's crazy dream. And it's like, there are only so many times you can say it was a dream before audiences are like, no, stop it. Yeah. Stop it now.
And like, I don't know, everyone's like, everyone wanted to see the season come back. I'm like, Yeah, it was fun, but it wasn't anything spectacular out of that Will and Grace season.
Well, and that's the thing. Like, I remember being obsessed with One Tree Hill when it was out, like, buying all the DVDs because that's how you used to watch it.
Then
binging it right after the other. And so there's a part of me that would go, One Tree Hill, that's exciting. But there's also a part of me that just goes, I wouldn't watch it. Like, that was a time of my life where I needed Chad Michael Murray. And I've very aggressively moved on from that time.
To be fair, I still do binge the OC. Oh. It just ages okay?
Seth Cohen will forever be like...
I liked Seth Cohen in the beginning when I first started, when I was like a 14-year-old kid.
Yep.
Like second, third rewatching, I'm like, I'm a total Ryan girl. How did I like Seth?
Oh, really? See, this is my, like, I'm worried. It's like the Gilmore Girls when they remade that and you realised how terrible Lorelai and Rory were.
Oh, my God. They are awful people. And they're complaining, like, their mum is awful. I'm like, you guys are awful.
Yeah. That's why I don't want to watch the OC anymore. I prefer Seth Cohen to be this god.
He was awful.
No, don't do it, Sophie.
Okay. Well, Tali, thank you for joining us this lovely Saturday morning on Gaggle of Geeks. We'll catch you next week.
Thanks, Sophie.
And if you want more, listen to our podcast, because we talk a lot, don't we?
Yes, we do. Yes, we do.
Till then.
Bye.
Tali Alatia right there on Gaggle of Geeks. You can listen to us chat for much, 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 much longer on the podcast. Just look for 2SER's Gaggle Geeks and you'll find us there. You are listening to So Hot Right Now, your weekly dose of arts and culture. And coming up, we're going to be chatting about the moon and bloodlines. But to get you there, here's a bit of Frankie Cosmos with Buses Splash with Rain.
I'm the kind of girl houses splash with rain. I'm the kind of girl. Buses splash with rain.
Newtown Record Fair is your monthly vinyl record fair in the heart of Newtown. On the first Saturday of every month, from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m, Newtown Record Fair features over 10,000 vinyl records of all genres, live DJs, tasty cucina menu, and craft beer bar. Your perfect vinyl record experience. Newtown Record Fair, in the back beer garden of the Bank Hotel Newtown. NewtownRecordFair.com.au, a vinyl record partner of 2SER.
You're listening to So Hot Right Now, your weekly dose of arts and culture. Bloodlines is a new exhibition that digs into the myths of nature and visualises how we interacted with the moon, and showing at the News Agency Gallery now. The exhibition is a collaboration across three generations of women, and one of the artists, Louise Campbell-Smith, is in studio to talk more about this project. Hello, Lulu.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you?
Good, thanks.
Big opening last night.
Yeah, it was really fun. Yeah. It was really good.
How'd it all go?
Yeah, it went really well. It was great because we could all be there at the exhibition opening together, and, you know, we hadn't attacked each other in the duress of actually putting the show up together as well.
It's always nice when that happens.
Yeah, it was really fun. It was great.
So this exhibition, it's three generations of women in your family. How did this project kind of come together?
Well, we've always individually worked on different things and painted and sculptured. And so it just sort of seemed like we should look at this together. And, you know, I think everyone has their own dose of what's going on in your life, and there's a lot of hecticness in the world, and we've really noticed a correlation between the moon and your emotions. And so that's why we thought maybe we should investigate this and present it as a collaborative show together.
I mean, the moon is also quite a feminine symbol in most cultures in a way. Did that kind of come into it as well?
Yeah, well, the moon being quite a feminine symbol definitely came into it. So we were sort of looking at a lot of aspects of nurture, but also as a masculine symbol, there's a lot of correlation with guys and girls, or whatever you'd like to be, a Z or whatever. So, so actually, I think the moon, beyond being just a feminine symbol, although we are, you know, looking at it from women's perspective mostly, it's about nurturing and looking after each other, even in times of hectic stress. And when you know, you can look up at the moon, especially a full moon, it can really bring out a lot of intense emotions in people. And it's really important to kind of carry on and, work with it.
Were you like looking at different phases of the moon in particular when you were looking at this project?
We were looking at different phases, but especially the full moon in relation to mental health. It's one of those things, like often if I'm having a bit of a hectic day, I'll think, oh yeah, I wonder how Miss J is doing. That's my sister, Jen.
Mm.
And 9 times out of 10, I'll get back and, yeah, she's had like a triple time of hecticness than I have. And often we'll have just been like, oh, what's, you know, going on? And you don't even realize, and you look, I'm like, oh, it's a full moon. Look at that moon. Okay, it's massive. All right, okay. That's what's going on, you know? So, yeah, I do feel like it really influences you.
Yeah. So you mentioned that, you know, you and your family members all do different practices of art. How did it all kind of come together into this project?
Well, we worked together on, like, Jen and I went up and visited Mom and Nanny, and we, one of the collaborative pieces we did, we each picked a colour that kind of represented us or we were feeling, and used the tones and variations of that, and we painted collaboratively on these canvases with a sort of an intuition of where we would go, and those pieces ended up really geometrically inclined, and it was really good working on them together and sort of knowing each other in a different way as well by doing that. So yeah, we had some work where we painted together and we sent things to each other and looked at different works and said, yes, that's good. Yeah, more of this. And yeah, and then it ended up on the walls finally. A few culls here and there, as you do. But oh, yeah.
Always a hard one.
Yeah.
So the show is called Bloodlines. Was it also kind of like that familial part in conjunction with the moon?
Well, yeah, definitely having our relationship as being related. Bess O'Malley, who runs News Agency Gallery, actually sent me this article, and it's so interesting because the egg that you are came from your grandma.
Mm.
And yeah, we kind of really did look at that path between us, like through our interconnectedness. And I think you can see in some of the mark making how that kind of translates and is expressed differently from each of us. So yeah, it's kind of really good being able to do something with your family and, yeah, work with these women who are so inspiring. And, you know, I have to add, there's a lot of women and men in our worlds that make things great and have sort of helped us to paint and create this.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Another thing you've created is this beautiful zine that I'm holding in front of me. It's also called Bloodlines. How did the zine all come together?
Well, I've been looking at different reflections, and I thought in like physical reflections of various materials, and with the idea of the light of the moon being, you know, a reflective or a contemplative manner, I thought putting some of the works in that might not have been featured so strongly. Like when I visited Mum, we had a day where we made some sand sculptures on the beach. So that kind of really made me think, oh, it would be really lovely to look at some of these textures that are a bit more hidden in our art making and bring them out. So yeah, black and white sort of seems to do the job for that. So, yeah, so it sort of just came together, putting different parts of texture together.
Because there's poetry and song in this as well.
Yeah, my nanny wrote this poem that I just loved, so that kind of also made me think, oh, maybe I should make a little zine and so I can include it. And actually last night, Jose, who works with Bess, said, okay, are you ready? Are you wanting to do this? So I got to read this out to the people that were there, and that was really special. It was really good.
Right. Well, the exhibition is open right now.
Yep, it's open right now. Adam and Jen are there. Go and drop in and say hello. And, yeah, have a look at the works.
Fantastic. It's called Bloodlines. It's at the News Agent Gallery in Petersham. Put all those details up on 2SER.com. But, Lulu, thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thanks so much.
We're going to jump back into the music. Now, here's a tune now from Oz Mutants. Kicked in the head by a horse.
We'll be right back.
This week on 2SER, well-pressed Texas outfit White Denim return with their new album, Performance. Riff rock swagger with a whole lot of boogie, Performance is the new 2SER feature album. Tune into Breakfast, Drive and Static for your chance to win copies. Performance by White Denim, this week's feature album on 2SER 107.3. Stories, ideas, music. You're here on So Hot Right Now with me, Sophie Lai, your weekly dose of art and culture right here on 2SER. It's not creepy if they're hot is the Sydney Fringe performance rebranding the coming-of-age genre. It's a third play from 19-year-old playwright Rosie License and is directed by Max Baum, who will be taking us through the tumultuous friendship of these 12 friends. Rosie and Max, join me in studio now. Good morning.
Hello.
Thank you for having us.
Not a problem. So going off the title... It's pretty loaded. So how did it all come about?
The title.
Mm.
So the title, when I started writing the play, I didn't really know what I wanted it to be about. So I chose the title first.
So you were going the Nanettes.
Sort of like, I just felt like that statement was this like really kind of ironic, like confusing statement that kind of summed up like the complexities of the way that we communicate, like, because it's sarcastic, but at the same time it's also kind of not, and there's some truth to it, so I felt like that kind of carries into some of the dialogue in the play as well. It's like a very self-reflexive kind of vibe going on.
Is it speaking from experience?
A lot of it definitely is, yeah. It's a lot of it's verbatim, so the way I did it was basically like archiving like my last 6 months. Like every time I go out, I'd like come home, write a scene. And so, yeah, absolutely. Some of it's just me trying to write down conversations and seeing how much I can remember from real life. So certainly real life, yes.
I mean, you know, most coming of age stories always have a bit of a dark tinge to it. Mm. So what were you both exploring in this?
So, as I said, I didn't really set out with any subject matter in mind, but unfortunately, like, when I spoke to people, the thing that came out the most was stories about, like, sexual assaults, being uncomfortable sexually, confusion in that area. So it was sort of like the subject matter chose itself. So I felt like that's just what it needed to be about. So I just had so much material, unfortunately, on that. So, yeah.
Ain't that the truth? Mm. So 12 friends, their friendship, a lot of people to wrangle. How was that, Max?
Even from the start, we were lucky enough because we sort of came out of student theatre, so we had a lot of people who were keen to audition in the first place, which was very lucky for us. So what we ended up having together as a team, and I think what really lets the play shine and why we have managed to like put something really, really special together is that everyone just really loves it, and everyone loves coming to rehearsal, and every time we come in we have a ball and we just put stuff together. And yeah, it's like every time that we've actually read the whole play as one, as a group, everyone's just, you know, cheering at the end of it. It's like, this is amazing. It just feels so special that everyone wants to get in there and make stuff happen. And so it ends up kind of like the play wrote itself. It's kind of putting itself together in the same way.
Excellent. And can you tell us a bit more about these characters and how their relationships kind of unfold a little bit? No spoilers, of course.
The way that we see it, I suppose, is probably a good way to put it. So the play is in three relatively short acts, and each one is kind of a different party. So we've got two parties and then a prize in the middle, but it also plays in reverse. So it's a little bit kind of all over there. And so I think what we end up seeing in terms of the relationship is kind of, they get up to these things and everyone just tends to be having a fun time, and so much of the party is just like hilarious and great. And looking back on this, we're going to be like, oh, how crazy is that? I can't believe that this happened. But then there's also the parts that it seems like we willfully forget. And so when we see it through the lens of the lead character, Liv, we sort of get this idea that we're hearing from what she remembers of the night, and it's truthful, but the things that she wants to forget eventually come back. And it's not in, you know, a particularly overt way, I suppose, because we do, I mean, the majority of the play is just hysterical and like a lot of fun, but that's what life is, you know, and that's what these things are like. And so it's sort of the sort of like, I guess, dark turns of the play end up coming out of nowhere. But what we end up seeing is just, you know, basically 2 weeks in the life of this friend group, and who all really like each other. They just don't really know how to be friends.
Yeah. So the first act is kind of like shows us like the surface of it all, and it all seems fine. And in a lot of ways, the characters that we kind of hate in the first act are the ones that we grow to love or feel sympathy for by the end. And the characters that we love in the first act are the ones that we kind of just question by the end. So I guess it sort of plays with the way that, the way that you make yourself likable, and how does that translate to your actual friendships? So like people who are popular, are they actually like, how are their friendships actually going?
I mean, you know, there's always that thing of editing your life to make it look better, especially in a place absolutely. Like Instagram. Does that kind of come into it as well?
Definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely.
So the way that
living
the play,
my best life.
The play is literally interspersed with a lot of stuff like that. So we've got between the three acts, there's these we're calling them slam poetry sections, but they're actually split up between the characters. So they don't seem like slam poetry when they're being said, but that's what they came from. They came from these beautiful poems that Rosie wrote, and that we've turned into this sort of like really cool kind of washy environment. You have to see it to understand it anyway. But in those scenes and during that, we have this AV, and we've literally got people on Snapchat and Instagram and posting stuff throughout the show, and we get to see that on the stage as well. So there is this wonderful thing about the show where, in the same way that we end up at first just seeing what Liv wants us to see, it's that sort of, you know, curated social media thing going on. We literally see what she's sending to people as well, and what people around the party are doing, you know, taking picture of like the drunk passed out guy on the couch and all those sorts of zooming in and out.
And then in one of the slams there's literally like a, what was it? Like maybe a
no spoilers.
400-word paragraph on how to make your ass look better in a pic. So, yeah,
the belfie.
Yeah.
So you know, sounds like a very fun but loaded play. But with the whole being set in reverse chronology, I can't even speak today. Does that really change the audience's interpretation of the play a lot?
I think in some ways what's kind of remarkable about it is that it almost seems to not matter that much, because there is this sort of like feeling that you get that each one of these events is kind of the same and they're kind of going through the same repetitions. And I guess what it adds is by the end of the play, it makes a lot of sense why it's structured that way. But I suppose as you're going through, it would be hard to tell if we didn't make it obvious which one came first. And so I think what the chronology does is it lets us, I suppose, meander through and actually have to think about, okay, so what's going on and why are these characters acting like this, and then progressively going, oh, that's why that happened. And it's kind of the same way, I suppose, that Liv, the main character, would be going through and thinking these things as well. She's like, why did so-and-so react like that? Oh, that's right, this happened, you know.
Yeah, I think that's the sad sort of message of the play, is that by the final act, we realise that all this stuff has happened before. Everything that happened, all the issues that occur in the first act have happened 2 weeks before, and no one has done anything to change it. And that's the, I guess that's the moral of the story.
Youth.
Yeah.
Youthful mistakes. But it's not creepy if they're hot. It's coming in the Sydney Fringe this September from the 11th to 15th of September at the Bondi Pavilion Theatre.
Yes.
Great venue.
Oh, it's amazing.
It's a great spot. It's
beautiful. Yeah, it's beautiful. Beautiful.
Good view as well. Yeah.
Do we all end up on the beach after? What's the situation?
Hopefully. Yes.
Beach party after. Everyone can buy it, totally.
But you can buy tickets now at the Sydney Fringe site. But Max and Rosie, thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you very much for having us.
Not a problem. If you want tickets, we'll put all those details up on 2SER.com. Can jump back into the music now. Here's the Amazing Snakeheads with Here It Comes Again. Amazing Snakeheads with Here It Comes Again. You've been listening to So Hot Right Now, your weekly dose of arts and culture right here on it to SER. My time here is just about up. A big thanks to all our guests, Alana Hunt from Temporary Certainty, Lulu Campbell-Smith from Blood.